Okay, on that subject, we're on to fluids and melts, right? This is the last of the so-called mineral physics lectures, although it's not supposed to be a comedy act. We'll see if it really is one. Thank you, all of you, for sitting so patiently through all of these lectures. I hope you find them illuminating. It's been a very large number of them, and I've certainly enjoyed them. There's been quite a diversity, but then again, I've been able to take a lot of the afternoons off, and many of you haven't, so I'm impressed. Okay. Melts and fluids in the mantle. There's a significant number of different sort of flavors of melts and fluids that we might consider to be in the mantle that are of interest in general. Some of them have greater or lesser relevance to the transition zone, at least in the modern Earth. But unfortunately, there's not really enough time to talk about all of them. Silicate melts, obviously, partial melting of mantle peridotite is something that we might want to talk about. But as we'll see, silicate melts unto themselves are unlikely to be stable in the transition zone in the modern Earth. The temperatures simply aren't hot enough. And so it's probably some more of these exotic things or combinations between silicate melts and these more exotic things that we would probably want to focus on. And I will be focusing largely, in fact, on the role of hydrous fluids in the mantle and in and around the transition zone. Last week you had a talk from Raj Dasgupta about the role of carbonatites, and they, in fact, may be interesting at significant depths in the mantle, but I'm not really going to say very much about them. Something else that we may consider are either sulfide melts, metal sulfide melts with certain amounts of oxygen in them. Those are also of interest. In fact, Stan Hart has a fairly recent, oh, actually, it isn't even recent, it's a preprint, talking about the possible role of sulfide melts in the mantle. And these are, in fact, stable at temperatures and pressures where regular silicate melts may not be, although perhaps not to depths as great as the transition zone. We learned from Peter van Kecken, of course, that cider is an important fluid that may be something that we could be interested in. And then something that I'm not going to talk about, but I would just wanted to put into your head is that there are classifications of materials in the mantle that don't fit easily into the classification of crystals and that have some characteristics of fluids, but you probably wouldn't necessarily think of them as fluids conventionally either. And those would be the sorts of materials that exist along grain boundaries, along very, very fine sort of nanometer scale interfaces. They have properties of, first of all, not having a regular structure, and in that case you might consider them to be amorphous and something like a melt or a fluid. And they may also store large amounts of interesting things like rare gases. So in some respects we may consider those to be something not so different from melts and fluids. Because silicate melts themselves in their dry, volatile, free state are not likely to be stable in the transition zone, we end up considering a lot about intermediate fluids, fluids that are hybrids between two or more of these categories. So for example, I'll actually be spending a fair amount of time talking about hydrous silicate melts, things that are some combination between water and silicate. One might also consider carbonated silicate melts. I won't be talking about those today, but they too might be of great interest. And then one could even make even greater hybrids, hydrous carbonated silicate melts and things like that. And undoubtedly such things are of interest in the mantle, but they just won't be covered today. Okay, so this is a phase diagram of partial melting of sort of canonical normal mantle peridotite as a function of depth. And the point that I wanted to make with this diagram is that the solidus, which is over here and here at the transition zone, is at remarkably high temperature compared to modern temperatures on the Earth. We know from all of the things that we've talked about over the course of the last 2 weeks that the temperature at the surface of the Earth, the mantle potential temperature, is in the range of 1400 degrees. By the time one gets up to pressures appropriate for those of the transition zone, maybe we're at 1500 or 1600 degrees. This is 400 or 500 degrees cooler than any kind of melting that we would get of mantle peridotite in the absence of agents that would lower the melting point of peridotite. So except perhaps at much, much greater depths at the core mantle boundary where there's speculation that within the thermal boundary layer that there might be melting of the mantle at very great depths, except for their melting of normal dry peridotite is only occurring in the modern Earth at depths probably about 5 GPa and below. The places like Hawaii and Iceland and things like that, we may consider melting as shallow as 5 GPa, but certainly in the transition zone, we're hundreds of degrees below the solidus. This is of importance also if we want to talk about the so-called hybrid fluids, like, for example, the combination of a hydrous silicate melt. If it's a hydrous silicate melt that's stable in the modern transition zone, then it's going to have enough of a flux, enough of the water present, to lower the melting point of the silicate by something on the order of 400 or 500 degrees. So that's something else that we'll want to keep in mind. Okay, I showed this slide in my lecture on Monday, and it's meant to consider the fact that water may be inducing melting in various places in the mantle, and there are these more conventional shallow places in the mantle that we've been aware of for a very long time, such as melting beneath island arcs, or the role of water of melting beneath ridges, or perhaps also beneath oceanic islands in the shallow regions. But more recently, we have come to appreciate that water may be inducing melting at the top of the transition zone or at the transition between the transition zone and the upper mantle. So we'll talk about that some this morning. Not going to talk about it specifically, but if this is possible, then certainly this is possible also, that more water-rich portions of the mantle upwelling through this boundary could be inducing melting, even if it's not occurring as a global feature. And then also something that I hope I'll have time to get to is the possibility that melting may be occurring when material goes from the transition zone down into the lower mantle as well. I'm surprised that we haven't seen this figure over and over again over the last couple of weeks. I expect that it would be shown many times, but you have seen it in various versions. Garrett showed a version of it yesterday, for example. There's a fairly interesting and controversial hypothesis put forward by Berkovici and Corrado a couple of years ago that there could be a global layer of melting at the top of the 410-kilometer discontinuity, and this melt layer would be a hydrous silicate melt. And it's been proposed that it has a number of important consequences for the dynamics and for the chemistry of the evolution of this system. So that's just something that I want to keep in mind. How much water is required for this? What are the consequences of it? Is it likely? What would be the properties of such a melt? Things we might want to consider. What do we know about water in the mantle just from observation at the surface? I talked about three places where we know water is participating in melting, and therefore we have some information about the amount of water in basalt source regions in island arc regions, where of course there's a huge amount of water associated with the fairly shallow circuit of subduction and hydrous melting. But we also have information about water in the mid-ocean ridge source regions and also in oceanic island source regions that come from the water concentration in the basalts that from these regions. And the estimates, which I'll talk a little bit about how we get these estimates in a moment, the estimates for the mid-ocean ridge source region are that the normal mantle beneath ridges has somewhere between 50 and 200 parts per million water in it. Evidence from oceanic islands, such as Hawaii and a few other places where these estimates have been made, are that these sources are richer in water. Not hugely richer in water, but you know, something like, we should probably lower this number to 300, maybe 300 parts per million to a little bit more than 1,000 parts per million. What does this mean for the total inventory of water in the mantle? Well, if we consider the possibility that most of the mantle has mid-ocean ridge-like water concentrations, then we can compare that integrated over the entire mantle to the amount of water on the surface, and we get a pie diagram that looks something like this. And that would be that if I've taken this mean concentration of 88 parts per million water in the mantle, and that would give us that 20% of the Earth's water is stored in the solid portion of the mantle, and 80% of the water is on the surface in the oceans. Right. On the other hand, if we consider that most of the mantle could be sort of oceanic island basalt source region in its geochemistry and its water concentration, then we would have the complete reverse. And that would be that the amount of water that we see on the surface is actually a fifth of the Earth's water, and that four-fifths of the Earth's water is in fact stored in the mantle. This is a difference of a factor of 16, and it's sort of interesting to me that, this is really fundamental. These are two different planets in some respects. One planet has put all of its volatiles on the surface, or virtually all the planets on the surface, and more or less dried itself out. This planet has kept almost all of its volatiles in its interior and only put a very small portion of it out. Imagine how different the geology would be between these two possibilities. And these are both our planet, it's just we just don't know which one we're on. So it's very interesting to me that there is potentially this amount of uncertainty, and this amount of uncertainty goes directly into the geochemical considerations that we might have discussed at various points about, you know, how much of the mantle is depleted mid-ocean ridge mantle, DMM-like mantle, and how much of the mantle is enriched in water and other trace elements. Louise mentioned, and it was mentioned yesterday, the possibility that we might have large reservoirs of argon stored in the lower mantle. If that's true, it's almost certainly true that those are also water-rich regions. And, you know, I actually don't favor this hypothesis, but we can't eliminate a priori the hypothesis that the Earth has kept most of its water in its interior. So these are things that that we would like to know about, and we'd also like to know the consequences for these different possibilities or these different possibilities for everything that we're talking about, you know, detecting these things by geophysics, the effect on the dynamics, the effect on the geochemistry, melting, and so on. Where do these numbers come from? For the most part, these numbers come from trace element geochemistry, in fact. And we actually saw a figure from this very same Kingley et al. Paper when John Eiler gave his talk. It's very difficult to measure the water in the source region of basalts. What we get, in fact, is the water in basalts themselves. And from that, we need to infer, first of all, hopefully, that this water is pristine. And when water, when basalt erupts under 2.5 or 3 kilometers of ocean, we tend to believe that that is, in fact, the case because they don't degas with respect to water. And what we see when we make measurements of the water of these abyssal basalts and compare them to trace elements is that they show very strong correlations with certain incompatible trace elements, in particular the light rare earth elements such as cerium. And these correlations are very regular, and they tell us that if we can make some estimates of the incompatible trace element budget of the region, that we can also therefore make estimates of the water concentration of the region, since these trends tend to follow quite linear relationships. So our estimates that I just showed a moment ago of how much water we have in these different source regions comes from correlation between measurements of water and measurements of trace elements, and all of the uncertainties attendant with the estimates of the trace element budgets of these various source regions are carried with that. Okay. I spoke on Monday about subduction of water and the role of these things called DHMS, dense hydrous magnesium silicates, in the subduction of water, and what influence that might have on the possibility that water is being put into the mantle in considerable volumes. Peter van Kecken then showed you that he had done some calculations that said that at least due pressure temperature depth paths or pressure temperature time depth paths in subducted slabs could follow such paths. It leads the possibility that in fact water is being delivered with these DHMS to considerable depths. So I'm not going to talk too much more about DHMS today. What I'm going to talk about is two other things. First of all, the other possible storage sites for water in the mantle. And those are not the DHMS, but the NAMS, the nominally anhydrous mantle silicates, such as wadsleyite and ringwoodite that we've already met, that can take certain amounts of water into their structure. They're not fundamentally hydrous. They can be anhydrous or hydrous. They do not have stoichiometric locations for hydrogen necessarily in their lattices, but nonetheless they store a certain amount of water. So I'm going to talk about that. And then the other thing I'm going to talk about a little bit is the actual act of melting or giving off of fluids and the character of the fluids that might be occurring any place from deep in the mantle here to shallower in the mantle here as well. Now, all of the mantle silicates and mantle phases and so forth have the possibility of taking small amounts of water as a trace constituent into their structure, just like all mantle silicates can take all sorts of trace elements as trace constituents in their structure. And at the very first day, I think, of lectures, Lars showed this diagram, which is the structure of wadsleyite. And wadsleyite is sort of special in this classification because wadsleyite seems to have a very specific site this underabundant oxygen that he pointed out, which allows Wadsleyi to take very large amounts of water. And this underabundant oxygen can take specific amounts of hydrogen, and it is possible to get weight percent water, sort of 3.5 weight percent water, into the Wadsleyite structure. It's not well understood, but this is also true of ringwoodite, in the sense that ringwoodite can also take very large amounts of water, although ringwoodite does not seem to have an easily identifiable crystallographic location for it. And we'll return to that at some point, I think. When we make observations of the amount of water that can be stored in Wadsleyite, this is a pure Mg2 SiO4 Wadsleyite, and this is iron-bearing Wadsleyite against temperature, a large number of different studies that I compiled some time ago. We see, in fact, that at low temperature, yes, we can get weight percent sorts of water in Wadsleyite. But as we go up in temperature to the temperatures that might prevail in the transition zone, say 1400 to 1600 degrees, it's not so clear that it's possible to have very large amounts of water in the structure. Now, something that's interesting and that isn't fully understood is that if you look at Mg2SiO4 and compare it to the iron-bearing data, there's a lot of scatter, but nonetheless, it does appear that the iron-bearing Wadsleyite retains water to higher temperatures than the magnesium-free Wadsleyite. And it's presumably the case that iron-bearing Wadsleyite is more able to make the sorts of defects that accommodate the hydrogen. But in fact, no one really knows for certain why this is. Okay, that's easy enough because, like I said, we know why Wadsleyite has water. It has these underbonded oxygens. Question? Oh, no. The Wadsleyite isn't stable at ambient pressure. These are all at pressures where Wadsleyite is stable, so probably 14 to 17 GPa. They're different pressures, but a fairly narrow range because you have to have that narrow range of pressure for Wadsleyite to be stable. Maybe 13 to 17 GPa. Yes, if that's right. If you have fully occupied, if the underbonded oxygen is fully occupied by hydrogen, you get a stoichiometric thing that looks like this, which has a very specific amount of water, and that's about 3.5 weight percent. That's right. And in fact, if we look at the experimental measurements, we see that things top out at about 3.5 weight percent. The fact that we have more water here probably reflects the fact that there's analytical uncertainty in a lot of these measurements. Okay? Yeah, I have told you that at high temperature, the amount of water that Wadsleyite will hold seems to be less, and I haven't told you why, but I'm going to return to that. Olivine is another phase that will take water. In fact, all of the mantle silicates, as I said, will take a certain amount of water. It's just a question of how much. And we know this in large part because of the infrared spectra of olivine. And Minock yesterday afternoon showed you some infrared spectra, I think, of olivine and also garnet. Was that correct? Right? And when we look at those, this is an experimental olivine that Cyril Obeau grew in my laboratory. This is a natural olivine from South Africa that he also observed. And these are three different crystallographic directions corresponding to the alpha, beta, and gamma vibrations, so that you can recall your optical mineralogy back then. And these are just normalized absorbance against wave number. And we see these absorptions in olivine in sort of like the 35, 50 or so energy band. And those wave numbers are well known to correspond to OH stretching vibrations. So this is evidence that there is hydroxyl stored in olivine. But one thing that is a little bit interesting about this, well, there's two things that are interesting, is first of all, notice the complexity of these spectra. Right? There's clearly not one single OH stretch. There's a range of OH stretches that are suggesting a range of different sorts of substitution of hydroxyl in olivine. Notice also that this olivine here doesn't have the same spectrum as this olivine here. It suggests that there are not only different kinds of substitutions, but different olivines have different populations of these substitutions. And notice also that definitely these vibrations are anisotropic. Depending on which way we look at the crystal, we see different stretches, which suggests that we're not looking at inclusions. In fact, it proves that we're not looking at inclusions or fluid inclusions or molecular water. But in fact, we're looking at crystallographically bound hydroxyl. People have worked very hard to take these hydroxyl stretches that show up in the IR and quantify them. And from that, we are beginning to have a fairly good idea of how much water one can get into olivine as a function of temperature and pressure. And it's considerable. So I've converted pressure to depth here. These are a number of different studies. And in fact, some of them use the IR technique that I was just sort of going over, but some of them use other techniques. And they show that by the time one gets to the depths equivalent to that of the end of olivine stability of about 400 kilometers, the concentrations can be as high as approaching half a weight percent. So this is a nominally anhydrous mineral that has an awful lot of water. And you know, just to give you a perspective on this, the most familiar nominally hydrous mineral to many of us is amphibole, right? And amphibole has 2 weight percent water in it. So nominally anhydrous olivine, you know, it's almost, you know, sort of within the same order of magnitude as amphibole, at least at these pressures. However, and this is important, the temperatures of these experiments are lower than those that we expect in the mantle at 400 kilometers, and therefore we have to be very suspicious as to whether or not these numbers are actually applicable to olivine in the mantle at 400 kilometers. This gets to the question of temperature, and there's a bunch of data on here. This is for wadsleyite, and in fact I've only put the Mg2SiO4 wadsleyite on here because there's so much analytical scatter in the data that it's harder to see it if one puts all the data here. And then these are those olivine data that I just showed you with some additional newer data at higher temperature. These are they're all sort of 13 to 17 GPA data, and the olivine data are the high pressure data that might apply sort of at depths of between 300 and 400 kilometers. And what we see is that at low temperature, indeed, we can get huge amounts of water into wadsleyite, but at high temperature, the amount of water that one can get into wadsleyite diminishes. And not surprisingly, we're beginning to see the same thing for olivine. So if we think about mantle temperatures at 410 kilometers, we may be talking about temperatures here where the wadsleyite may be only able to take maybe perhaps half a weight percent water. And the olivine, it's not clear, but perhaps 1,000 parts per million or something like that. Okay, what is this? Is this some intrinsic property of the mineral that suddenly refuses to take hydroxyl at high temperature? No, in fact, it's probably not. Probably it's something else. It is that all of these experiments were done in the presence of fluids, and the fluids are changing their composition as one goes up in temperature. And therefore, the water activity, or the water fugacity, if you will, in these fluids is not the same here, where the fluids are perhaps nearly pure water, and here, where the fluids are some intermediate mixture between water and silicate melts, and similarly for here as well. This has the what people sometimes say is that this is solubility, whatever solubility is. This is the amount of water you can get into the mineral in the presence of water. And this is something else. They may say that this is hydrous melting. The mineral is beginning to melt, and therefore you are limited in the amount of water that you can get into the mineral. I don't like to make that distinction. It is clearly some kind of continuous process. And so I'd like to sort of step you through a couple of diagrams that I think are perhaps a better way to think about it. This is a cartoon. a cartoon for a hypothetical silicate mineral that takes some amount of water into its structure. And it takes water into its structure depending on the composition of the fluid or the melt that it's in equilibrium with, and also depending on the temperature and the pressure. At low pressure, the phase diagram may look something like this. At low temperature in this diagram, the mineral is in equilibrium with the fluid. But at high temperature, it is possible for that mineral to take more and more hydroxyl into its structure because of the intrinsic properties of the substitution of the hydroxyl into its structure. But beyond a certain temperature, this mineral begins to melt, and therefore it's not any longer in equilibrium with this very water-rich fluid. It skips, or the fluid composition that's present in equilibrium with this mineral skips to this over here, which is something that we would call a hydrous melt. And because this is a hydrous melt, and as one goes to higher and higher temperature, the melt has less and less water in it, the mineral too has less and less water in it. So we expect a sort of behavior of increasing solubility, if you will, or increasing storage capacity in the mineral with increasing temperature. And then once the fluid changes from a water-rich fluid to a melt, a reversal. At high pressure, one may see this much more continuously, because at high pressure, there may not be a strong distinction between fluids and melts. There may not be a miscibility gap where melt and fluid can coexist. And therefore, one may go continuously from a water-rich fluid to a silicate-rich hydrous melt, but nonetheless, one still expects this general behavior of increasing solubility with, or increasing storage capacity with increasing temperature, and then a reversal. We see experimental evidence for this. These are some experiments of Zhao et al. At low pressure, looking at the amount of water that goes into olivine as a function of temperature, and it illustrates this sort of behavior here. And we see also, I've already shown it to you, experimental evidence for the opposite case at high pressure, where with increasing temperature, the amount of water that one can put into Wadsleyite diminishes. Okay? This phenomena of the changing composition of the fluid has received considerable attention amongst mineral physicists and geochemists and petrologists in the last few years, because we have become sort of enamored of the fact that it's possible to have this intermediate fluid, which is a supercritical fluid, something in between that of water and silicate. Another way to look at this is a sort of a sketch phase diagram like so. So this would be some mineral that at low pressure, which would be this trace over here, would partially melt to a hydrous melt. At higher pressure, it would also partially melt to a hydrous melt. But in the water-rich portions of the diagram, one will have a miscibility gap between a water-rich fluid over here and a hydrous silicate melt over here. This is basically a three-dimensional temperature composition pressure projection of the same diagram that I showed you over here. So this would be the low-pressure version, and here's this big miscibility gap. And at high pressure, the miscibility gap has gone away. People have investigated these now experimentally. These are some experiments from almost 10 years ago showing the closing of the miscibility gap between fluid and melt. This happens to be experiments done with albite. So here, as a function of temperature, the melt is becoming more hydrous. The fluid is having more and more silicate dissolved in it. And at a certain temperature, the distinction goes away. There's some really nifty experimental ways to examine this in the diamond anvil cell. So these sequence of pictures actually were taken at temperatures equivalent to the very top of this miscibility gap, where at temperatures just below the top, one can actually see a vapor bubble coexisting with a silicate melt. And then stepping up a few degrees, these distinctions become less and less distinct until you have a single fluid over here. So using the hydrothermal diamond anvil cell, people have been able to investigate the mutual miscibility between water and silicate. Unfortunately, the limits of this technique are that it requires a very stable temperature field. Normally, when we work with diamond anvils, or people who work with diamond anvils, they do their heating by laser heating of a certain spot within the diamond anvil. But you can imagine that if you wanted to do this sort of study, that wouldn't work very well. You need a very homogeneous field to see the difference between two phases stable and complete homogeneity. So instead, people use the so-called hydrothermal diamond anvil cell. I'm not really sure exactly why it's called hydrothermal. It was probably better or more appropriately called an externally heated an externally heated diamond anvil cell. And the limitation of an externally heated diamond anvil cell is that there's a resistive heater around the entire object instead of just a local spot being heated with a laser. And as a consequence, the seedings of the diamonds become unstable at high temperatures and pressures. And these only work, unfortunately, at the moment to relatively modest pressures of a couple GPa and relatively modest temperatures of perhaps 1,000 degrees or so. What this means is that we have not been able to investigate, for example, transition zone conditions directly with this technique. These lines here are traces of the top of the miscibility gap for a number of substances. So they're basically investigations of the top of the miscibility gap to the point where there is no longer a distinction at higher pressures where one simply cannot find a vapor and a melt coexisting. For a number of materials, nepheline, jadeite, albite, and so forth, all aluminosilicate materials that are probably of most interest in the crust. And what one sees is that at temperatures of about 600 or 700 degrees and pressures of about 2 GPa or so, they all reach the point where above that pressure there is no longer any distinction between a melt and a hydrous melt and a water-rich fluid. So they all reach what we would call their second critical endpoints. Unfortunately, this is true for these aluminosilicate materials, but it does not seem to be true for materials of interest in the mantle. Basalts, peridotitic materials, and so forth, all seem to have their second critical endpoints at much, much higher pressures. So we have not been able to investigate them directly with these techniques. On the other hand, more conventional experiments do give us a guide as to where it is that fluids in equilibrium with the mantle may go through this transition. So these are some more conventional quench experiments of fluids in equilibrium with olivine and orthopyroxene, or more specifically, pure forstrite and pure enstatite as a function of pressure. So this is experiments in the system MgO, SiO2, H2O. These fluids consist just of MgO, SiO2, and H2O. And as one goes up in temperature at, say, 6 GPa, one sees basically a water-rich fluid that increases a little bit in MgO and then jumps up to a much higher amount of MgO and also jumps up to a much higher amount of silica. So clearly at 6 GPa, it's possible to go from a water-rich fluid to a silicate-rich melt in this system. At 9 GPa, it is also possible. I don't know exactly why in this study there are 9 GPa data for this leg and 10.5 GPa data for this leg, but one can see that this distance is beginning to close. And so all we really know is that probably in the mantle-associated system, that this second critical endpoint, where there's no longer a distinction, is somewhere above 10 GPa, but probably not very far above 10 GPa. So presumably, once one gets to the transition zone, we have continuous possibility of water-rich fluids to hydrous silicate melt. Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. If one has water, I mean, that is perhaps best well, I could use this diagram here to illustrate that. This is not the mantle, of course. This is albite. But albite alone, dry, will melt at some temperature here, and the addition of water greatly lowers the melting point. Actually, we will get to that. We'll get to a more mantle-relevant example of that presently. Okay, so geochemists have been very excited about the fact that there are these supercritical fluids, but it isn't really that mysterious. And Craig Manning wrote a very nice paper a couple of years ago that pointed out that your basic intuition about this should be not so different from how it always was. And that is that he has shown the case here where one has a distinct leg of hydrous melting as compared to a water-rich fluid, or the higher pressure case here where one has a continuous change in composition. It is still true that at low temperature, the only fluid that is going to be stable, whether you're at low pressure or at high pressure, is going to be very water-rich and have very little dissolved silicate in it. And it is still true that at high temperature, irrespective of whether or not you were at low pressure or high pressure, the fluid that's in equilibrium with your mineral is going to be chiefly silicate with a small amount of water in it. So if I tell you that you're at some pressure, and you don't really know whether or not this phase diagram applies or this phase diagram applies, you still do know that a low-temperature fluid will be water-rich and a high-temperature fluid will be silicate-rich, irrespective of whether or not there's a miscibility gap. Okay. We're going to return to melting in a bit, but I'm going to Now move to the effect of water on the solids, and in particular the effect of water on the solids at the transition between olivine and wadsleyite at the 410 kilometer discontinuity. This has been touched on a couple of times already this week. Bernie Wood in 1995 made this very, very interesting point that the different solubility or the different storage capacity of water in wadsleyite compared to that of olivine should stabilize wadsleyite at the transition and should do a number of things to the boundary. It should, number one, make the boundary shallower because wadsleyite gains stability by taking the water relative to olivine. And number two, that it should thicken the interval. So this is an example of, actually these are figures from his paper, where here he's showing basically the dry phase diagram. Here he's zooming in on that dry phase diagram and showing the calculated effect of a small amount of water, whereby, first of all, the transition moves to lower pressure, and second of all, the transition thickens in FEMG space, or also thickens in pressure space as compared to the dry one. We address this by doing the same sort of calculation that we have done previously, where we look at the exchange of magnesium and iron between the phases. However, in this case, we need to take into account somehow the effect of water on the activities of the different components participating in the reaction. We don't know how to do that, in fact, but we've made some guesses. And the guess that Bernie made and that many people have made otherwise is that if we understand something about the substitution of hydrogen in wadsleyite, we can write down a stoichiometric hydrous component and say that any partially hydrous wadsleyite is some mixture of two components, a dry component and a hydrous component, and that therefore the activity of the dry component would be the same sorts of things we would write already, the activity coefficient of the magnesium component, the mole fraction of the magnesium component, and some factor taking into account the fact that there's a certain amount of hydroxyl present that is creating this component here. And the reason that this is a 1/2 is because the stoichiometric component has a 1/2 there. That's a guess, and one can imagine that there could be all sorts of possibilities. For example, this activity coefficient here is conventionally written in terms of iron-magnesium effects. We have no idea whether or not this activity coefficient is in fact influenced by the presence of the hydroxyl. It would be nice to know. For olivine, it's even worse, because for olivine, we're not even really sure what the substitution is. And I showed you these spectra before. And what I didn't say, what I did say is it looks like there's a possibility of a number of different substitutions just based on the energy of the OH vibrations. And I didn't say exactly how the hydroxyl is substituted into the olivine. And in fact, there's some debate about that. What we do know is that the sum of the hydroxyl in the olivine is the sum of all the different point defect substitutions in that olivine. And there could be many. And it has been the job of a number of people over the last 10 years to try to figure out what these substitutions are. But before I tell you that why we think that this is probably the main one, let me introduce you a little bit into this sort of mysterious notation, which undoubtedly many of you have encountered and maybe have scratched your head a little bit about. People who work on point defect chemistry have adopted this thing called Kroger-Vink notation. And that is that they look at point defects in terms of, first of all, what the defect is. In this case, this would be hydrogen going into the mineral. Second of all, where the site it's going into is. So that's the subscript here. I would mean that it's going into an interstitial site, a site that would otherwise not be occupied in the stoichiometric mineral. ME, in this case, would mean that it's going into the metal site, the place where the iron or the magnesium normally goes. Or SI, in this case, means that it would be going into the site that is normally occupied by silicon. So we have the point defect, the place that it's going, and the effective charge of the point defect. And don't ask me why this was done by Kroger and Vink in the 50s, but instead of just giving you pluses and minuses, they adopted these funny other symbols that you now have to learn. So a filled circle is a point defect that has a charge of +1. So putting a hydrogen into an interstitial site gives you an effective charge of +1. A little prime symbol here is an effective charge of -1. a hydrogen substituting for a place where there would normally be a 2 plus cation has an effective charge of minus 1, or the substitution does, so it gets a little prime there. A substitution that is charge neutral gets an X. So putting two hydrogens in place of some place where there would normally be an Mg2 plus is charge neutral, and so that gets an X. You can see here putting a hydrogen in a place of silicon, that's a charge deficit of 3, and so you have an effective charge of 3 prime there. All of these are possible, but recently it's been argued that this one is the one that actually dominates, and that's based on, in part, on interpreting the spectra of the FTIR and comparing it to first principles calculations for the different possible point defects, and also arguments associated with the slip systems that might be excited during deformation and relating those to the weaknesses within the lattice. If we believe that this is the only substitution, then we can do the same thing that we just did a moment ago for Wadsleyite, and we can write down an activity composition relationship for the olivine. If we acknowledge that it's probably not a single substitution, but it's probably some family of substitutions giving rise to each of these little bumps, then we will have a considerably more difficult time writing down this relationship. Cinti? Well, see, this is an experimental olivine, and this is a natural olivine, and they have different spectra. And in fact, not all natural olivines have the same spectra. Not all experimental ones have the same spectra. And it's been a considerable headache, actually, relating each of these variable sorts of spectra to exactly what substitution is occurring. The only thing that we can say is that sometimes, and not always, sometimes we can reproducibly generate the same spectra experimentally at the same temperatures and pressures and buffering conditions, but not always. It's been quite a mystery, actually. I guess one thing to say is that putting hydroxyl into a phase-like olivine, apparently there are lots of sites that are not so different from one another in energy, and consequently, lots of different sites get populated according to very subtle differences in the point defect chemistry of the mineral. Okay. So if one writes down these models with all of their simplifications, one now has the ability to proceed with the sort of calculation that Bernie did to calculate the effect of water on the transition. One needs one additional piece of information, and that is the relative propensity of water to go into Wadsleyite relative to that of olivine. And there are some now direct studies of that, but we can also take that indirectly from a plot like this, where we see that approximately the factor is something about like 5. That is to say that at the same temperature, the Wadsleyite has about 5 times that much water as the olivine. When Bernie did this in 1995, he assumed that the factor was 10. And it arguably may be 10, and sometimes you get an order of magnitude here. Usually it seems to be a little bit less. So if you do this calculation, you can calculate the thickening of the 410 kilometer discontinuity according to the amount of water that's present. This would be a partition coefficient of 1, which is basically the same thing as dry. There's no relative preference, so it doesn't thicken the transition at all. And in this particular calculation, I get a thickness of 7 kilometers. That's something that we can all agree is close to normal. If the partition coefficient is 10, as Bernie argued, then you cannot have a normal thickness transition layer, meaning something less than 10 kilometers, unless you have a very, very dry mantle, just 100 or 200 parts per million water. On the other hand, if the relative preference value, the partition coefficient, is 5, we may permit a few hundred parts per million of water present, but certainly not, let us say, 1,000 parts per million. Then we would be definitely exceeding the envelope of a normal transition layer. The few places in the world, such as beneath Italy, that where it's been observed or suggested seismologically that the transition might be thicker, also have some implications for how much water is associated with that thickening. And depending on what the partition coefficient is, it's numbers in the hundreds to perhaps 1,000 or 1,500 parts per million water. So that's not as wet as the mantle can be, we believe, in terms of the storage capacities. And it's a guide for what perhaps is a reasonable range. am I doing for time? Okay. So those are calculations based on some fairly simple assumptions about the way the phases actually behave. There are actually now two experimental studies that investigate this, one by Smith and Frost, where they investigated the thickness of the transition dry, that's the same familiar diagram as you've seen before, and then added a small amount of water to the system, and they saw two things. First of all, that the transition goes to lower pressure, and second of all, that it broadens. Notice how the two-phase loop is now wider here. And then Chen et al., the group from Stony Brook, did a similar set of experiments, albeit at a slightly different temperature. And they, too, showed that the transition moved to lower pressure. So this is their dry experiments, and these are their wet experiments. But they used a great deal more water. They're actually water-saturated in these experiments. And one interesting thing is that whereas they see the transition going to lower pressure, they do not see a broadening. That is to say that the FEMG partitioning that is here in the wet case is not so different from the FEMG partitioning that's seen in the dry case. So one may take this as possibly contradictory, right? That everybody agrees that water will make the transition go to a shallower depth, but the experiments don't seem to agree as to whether or not they will thicken the transition or not. In fact, the difference is probably explicable by the fact that this is a small amount of water and this is a large amount of water. We can take the same sort of calculation that I just showed you here, which has these simple thermodynamic models for the phases. And then we can add the possibility of melting. We can say beyond a certain amount of water in the olivine and wadsleyite, there's also going to be melting. And then we can predict not just the thickness of the transition, but also the location of melting and the effect of melting on the transition. And that's what these diagrams are here. So this is for a different amount of water in olivine coexisting with wadsleyite, the transition of olivine to wadsleyite beginning here at all wadsleyite 1 to all olivine here. So as we go through the transition for this bulk composition with a certain amount of water, the olivine slowly increases in its mole fraction according to, 1 minus these numbers. The wadsleyite decreases in mole fraction according to these numbers. And both of them, as they go through the transition, increase in their water concentration. We start making a water-poor phase at the expense of a water-rich phase, but we have the same total amount of water. In order for the same total amount of water to be partitioned between those two phases, they both increase in their water concentration. If we do this with more total water, that's these lines here, and at a certain point, the olivine and the wadsleyite reach their saturation, and they are forced to be in equilibrium with a water-rich melt. An interesting consequence of this is that as the wadsleyite becomes richer and richer in water, it becomes more and more stable, which is to say that's what's actually thickening the transition. The reason that we get a thick transition in the presence of water is that the wadsleyite takes water, gains stability from it. But once melting begins, wadsleyite is limited in the amount of water that it can take, which means that it cannot increase its water concentration, which means it cannot increase its stability. This is the same series of calculations done this way for olivine and wadsleyite in a dry system, olivine and wadsleyite in the presence of 1,000 parts per million and so forth, showing the proportion of olivine to wadsleyite. So this is the beginning of the transition. We're in the transition zone here. This is the end of the transition. We have no more wadsleyite. And we can see the thickness of the transition here. And we can also see that as we add more and more water to modest amount, the last bit of wadsleyite hangs on and hangs on to very shallow depth because it's getting so water-rich and because it's getting so stable. On the other hand, if we start with a system that is so water-rich that it's saturated the entire way through, that there's excess water present all the way through, then we end up with a very thin transition because there's no change in the water concentration in the phases as we go through the transition. So that looks like this. A dry transition is thin and deep, relatively deep. A damp transition, it thickens. A transition that is such that there's enough water around that melting will occur does have melting at the very top of the system. And then a system that's completely saturated occurs at the shallowest depth, but isn't any thicker than the dry transition. So this sequence here is actually perhaps it has a series of predictions for what we would expect in the mantle in the presence of water. The observations in the Mediterranean might be appropriate for something like this, but if we believe that there is hydrous melting going on at the top of the transition zone, or at the very base of the upper mantle, then, first of all, at least from the point of view of phase equilibria, it's not possible to make a very thick layer. It's not possible to make a 20 or 30 kilometer thick layer just by phase equilibria. If we do observe such a layer seismologically, then we need some dynamical explanation for it beyond just imposing a phase diagram. It also reconciles the experimental data that I showed you before. In the presence of a large amount of water, we do expect a shallow transition, but not a thick transition. In the presence of a small amount of water, we expect a shallow transition also, at least compared to the dry case, but a thick one. Okay, I want to do two more things. One is to talk about this melt layer and to talk about the possible persistence of this melt layer owing to the possibility that it may be dense relative to the surrounding mantle. Right? The whole idea behind the Berkovici-Corrado hypothesis is that melting occurs when wet transition zone material reverts to olivine-bearing material that cannot hold all the water, but that this melt stays here because the melt is negatively buoyant relative to surrounding mantle. There are some recent experiments that suggest just how this might work. This is Sakamaki et al. It's not possible actually to make direct density measurements on the melts of interest at the temperature and pressure of interest. So instead, what people have done is they have made measurements of the density of melts by putting in markers, like diamond is a preferred one, and if the diamond sinks or the diamond floats, and since we know the equation of state of diamond, we can infer the density of the melt in which it is sinking or floating. And so these experiments have been done here, where they've been done with a basaltic melt. Notice that these temperatures are very high. They have to correct the temperatures down to natural temperatures. They've been done again with a slightly hydrous melt, one with 2% water, and then yet again with 8% water. If they correct these for temperature, what they find for the density of the melts as a function of temperature and pressure compared to that of, let us say, PREM. So this is the interesting part here, the very bottommost part of the olivine-bearing mantle, is that indeed the dry melt goes through a region where it is denser than PREM. And in fact, a melt with a small amount of water is also potentially denser, but that a melt with a large amount of water is always buoyant relative to the solid. The same exercise can be converted to a melt of a slightly different composition, making assumptions about the equation of state of the melts, and one gets essentially the same answer. A modestly wet melt may be negatively buoyant, but a very wet melt won't be. This very same exercise was done by another group out of Yale, and this is Matsukagi et al., who considered the same sorts of... they used slightly different melt compositions, and their experiments were a little bit different, but they are effectively the same, and then ask the question, how would the effect of water on the density of the melt have to be in order for one to get the sink-float relationship at 410? And they did this in terms of a quality that we saw yesterday afternoon in one of the research talks, which is the partial molar volume of water. And the idea would be that if you add water to the melt and that water has a high volume, meaning it greatly increases or decreases the density, then only a small amount of water can be tolerated. On the other hand, if the water component of the melt is itself quite dense, then a very large amount of water can be tolerated, and you can still get the negative buoyancy. So one can translate this to say that the uncertainty in the partial molar volume of water translates to an uncertainty as to how much water you can have in such a melt layer and still have it be negatively buoyant. And most estimates of the value of this are down in this range here, but perhaps one may tolerate values as great as or as small as 6 grams per mole, or cc's per gram, I guess. But let's remember that in order for this to be correct, we also have to have the melt stable at these conditions. And so this gets me back to the beginning. We're talking about conditions over here. We're talking about conditions 400 or 500 degrees colder than the mantle would melt on its own. So in order for the mantle to melt at these temperatures, owing to the agency of water, we have to have a lot of water present. And so this is a collection of experiments at approximately the appropriate pressure and a range of temperatures, so for partial melting of peridotite and the amount of water in that peridotite. And what they show is that at the temperatures of interest, sort of the 1400 to 1600 degree temperatures, there's sort of not an absence of perfect data or an absence of data completely, but it looks like you need, 20% water, 30% water, something like that, to stabilize a melt at these temperatures or to affect enough solidus lowering from the completely dry case, which is here, to the case of interest there. Now this... No, they're at two different pressures. The Litasov and Otani ones are just below the transition, meaning just deeper than the transition, and the Kawamoto ones are just above it. There's a difference of about a GPA in the experiments. But considering the rest of the uncertainties, I wouldn't sell that we know these values very well. Broadly speaking, at the temperatures of interest, we're talking about tens of weight percent water required. So comparing that to this calculation here, which shows that at the outside, in fact, it's possible that we may get sinking of a magma if the water content is sort of in the 15 to 25% range, if the partial molar volume of water is very small, suggests that we cannot eliminate this hypothesis at the moment, but some rather extreme values of the range of possibilities would be required. Oh, yeah, but we're not comparing these to olivine. We're comparing these to PREM, so that's in there. So this is the real density. Well, to the extent that seismology gives us the real density, it's the this is not the density of olivine. This is the density of the mantle that we're comparing it to. Yes. Yeah. Sakamaki used a MORB melt. Matsukage used another melt that they asserted was the appropriate composition for a small degree melt at these pressures and temperatures. And whether or not those melts have the right amount of iron and the right amount of calcium and other dense components is unknown. Okay, I have one more thing I want to do quickly, and then I will finish. Oh, actually, I will skip this one. This is fun, but I'll skip it. Okay, I just want to briefly talk about the lower mantle, because the lower mantle is an area of really interesting uncertainty at the moment in terms of the behavior of water. Right. So this cartoon again shows us the possibility that water may be delivered to the lower mantle, and then once we get beyond a certain depth, we do not know of any DHMS, dense hydrous magnesium silicates, that are stable, and so the question then becomes, are there hosts within the normal lower mantle mineralogy for water? And if not, what are the consequences? And there are a series of studies that have occurred over the last few years on this, and they diverge quite greatly. And of course, the first phase you'd want to know about is aluminous magnesium perovskite. And here are two different studies, one out of Japan and one out of Germany. And this one suggests that the storage capacity of aluminous magnesium perovskite is about 1,500 parts per million, which is to say, take a fair amount of water into the mantle. Remember that I used that value before of 1,400 parts per million. That was the most of the water in the Earth is in the mantle. This would tolerate that hypothesis. The group out of Bayreuth in Germany came to very, very different conclusions. They could only stuff 20 parts per million water in aluminous perovskite. This is a disaster, right? Not only can't we get large amounts of water into the lower mantle, we can't get normal amounts of water into the lower mantle. This is an order of magnitude less than the typical amounts of water in the upper mantle. It suggests, if it's correct, and if there's no other host for water, it suggests that any normal upper mantle material, not just subducted DHMS, but any normal upper mantle material would have to shed some sort of hydrous melt on entry into the lower mantle. If this is correct, then we have a lot of head scratching to do. It has been suggested, and not just by the Germans, but also by the co-authors of the Japanese in private, that this is perhaps the right result for these materials. And the reason is this. The caption got cut off, but this is a sample of the magnesium perovskite that was looked at in Bayreuth. And these things here are little inclusions of hydrous phases. They're actually inclusions of superhydrous B. So it's been suggested that these spectra here include inclusions that are not stable in the system and that have a large amount of water in them. And that actually is not too surprising considering the broadness of these spectra. I've been told privately that these experiments also have these inclusions in them. On the other hand, also unpublished, I've seen data from Steve Jacobson, who has done similar experiments where he's not only using aluminous magnesium perovskite, but he also has iron in the system, and he has considerably more water that he detects in the magnesium perovskite. Something he hadn't quantified it, something not quite as high as this, but a lot larger than this. If that's the case, then the crisis is averted. Because if there's no tolerance for water in the lower mantle, we have to ask all sorts of questions, right? I mean, first of all, we would have this melting. What are the consequences of this melting? What's the fate of this melt? We believe that oceanic island basalts come from lower mantle, most of us do. If it can't get the water in the oceanic island basalts, then that would be a big problem. And then indeed, this whole idea of a deep water cycle that many of us are working on would perhaps be truncated at sort of 670 or depths just below it. And that may be trouble for understanding all sorts of cycling of not just water, but also incompatible trace elements in the mantle. Okay? Stay tuned. I'm not saying that this is true, but some evidence has suggested it. And that's what I'll stop with. Thanks. Garrett. Yes, some of us do. I think it's pretty clear that wadsleyite will not be fully hydrous at mantle temperatures, right? You can't get 3% water into wadsleyite at 1500 degrees. So it's pretty clear that the tolerance for wadsleyite's somewhere between 0.5% and 1%. The number I like is 0.75%, but there's uncertainty in that. The debate actually is with the olivine. And the data that I showed are all tending to agree on, I think they're all tending to agree on at relatively low temperatures that you can get a fair amount of water into the system. There are some who argue that the way that the IR is calibrated is incorrect and that therefore we're exaggerating the amount of water. But not all of these data are from IR. Some of them are from SIMS. So I don't think that's an issue. But we can return to that. But what I'd like to point to actually is no matter what one thinks about this, the real uncertainty is here. We don't really know what olivine does at high temperature. We have a few data points. Joe Smith has a few data points that I think are a little higher than this, but that aren't yet published. But the real uncertainty is to the water storage capacity of the upper mantle just below the 410. Really isn't the calibration issues here. It's that we don't really have data at the temperatures of interest. Barbara? I didn't say very much about ringwoodite. The experimental data suggests that ringwoodite takes weight percent water, 2.5-3 weight percent water. However, to my knowledge, ringwoodite hasn't been the subject of a great deal of debate. So to my knowledge, there aren't a lot of data for ringwoodite at high temperatures, so I don't know what the limits are or the behavior. I expect it's not so different from this, but I don't know. Tom, have you seen any high temperature data for ringwoodite? Yeah. Definitely at lower temperatures, ringwoodite is kind of like wadsleyite in its storage capacity. It takes weight percent water, no question about it. I don't know about it at high temperature. Julie? I will repeat the question if you repeat the question. Okay, so the question is how about the non-olivine phases, and in particular majoritic garnets? Well, in fact, we saw a little bit of data yesterday that suggested that you can get a small amount of water into into garnet. It wasn't a majoritic garnet, but much, much less than what one can get into olivine or wadsleyite. And in fact, I've seen a range of studies. We have a lot of work to do because garnet is a very complex phase. Majoritic garnets may be different from aluminous garnets, but pretty much all of them suggest that garnet's a minor player in the total storage capacity. Yes, there is just one study, and it is the same study as the Murakami et al. And these are spectra for magnesium perovskite. They got very similar results for calcium perovskite, sort of 1,000 to 1,500 ppm. But because this study is, you know, sort of under question for other reasons, I think the real statement would be we don't know. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I could add that, right? I mean, we all know that water has a huge effect on the rheology of upper mantle phases, probably has a significant effect of rheology on transition zone phases, probably has a strong effect on rheology of things like perovskite, although, of course, there are no such measurements. And so if this were the case, it might tend us toward the conclusion that there would be an even greater rheological contrast than there would otherwise be just based on comparison of the dry phases. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the first question we have to ask is what's its buoyancy relative to the surrounding mantle? So the debate at the moment is it negatively buoyant and doesn't want to stay there, or is it positively buoyant and want to rise? If it's positively buoyant and wants to rise, then presumably there's no barrier to it rising in the sense that it's presumably interconnected and the permeability is probably finite and it probably will go up. And in fact, it has been suggested that this sort of phenomena, local phenomena, could be associated with kimberlites or other sorts of extreme hydrous magmatism. But it's very speculative. Alan? Not this one, but the actual observations? Yeah. Well, it's more than a normal amount. It will store a normal amount, right? Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Between these two studies, if I were told that one of these must be right and really apply to the mantle, I would go with this one. However, I don't think that the story is done, and I was very encouraged by the preliminary data I saw of Steve Jacobson that said that when you add iron to the system, the story changes. People use generic calibrations for these that are based on correlations between the extinction coefficients and wave number that were developed a long time ago. I'm sorry to say, based on glasses. So they're not very well known, and they easily have a factor of three uncertainties in them. Mm-hmm. Well, there surely are implications for other planets. I don't know that where I would want to begin. The conventional place where people start on that story is the comparison between Earth and Venus. And the idea being that Venus seems to be dehydrated, and consequently that it may have a much stronger lithosphere, and consequently that may be a very significant reason why Venus has tectonics that are so different from that of Earth. People have said a lot about that. What we know, of course, is that Venus's atmosphere is very dry. Whether or not there's water storage in the interior of Venus, good question. What about the asthenosphere? You know what? The asthenosphere is a place where there's a possibility of a lot of things happening, including carbonated melt, which I'm not talking about, but I'm a bit of a fan of. There's probably very little possibility that the storage capacity of water and its profile through the Earth intersects the actual adiabat in the mantle at the asthenosphere, which is to say, I do not think that there's a small amount of hydrous melting that is generating the asthenosphere. However, I do know of a group in Germany that recently has been trying to make that case. I find it very unconvincing. Adam. You know, the people who've been working on this, that to my knowledge, are Steve Jacobson and Joe Smith, and they've been measuring seismic velocities in hydrous olivine and hydrous wadsleyite, and they have been able to measure the effect. But as far as the value of the derivative, or you know, VXH2O or something like that, I don't know the number. It's reputed to be. Yeah, and I think Corrado has made arguments that if you make maps of Q and also VPVS, that he can map out regions that are the effect of water as compared to, say, the effect of temperature. But they're not based on a lot of experimental data. Matt? Yeah, you would be starting with a rheologic law that we don't know and perturbing it in another way that we don't know. Dan? The whole thing? Oh, dear. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I don't agree. First of all, I don't think we can decouple water from the trace elements. If we have trouble with storage of water in these reservoirs, I think the trace elements must track that. We don't see huge variations in water cerium ratios. So I think of that backwards. I think that, you know, if this is right, you know, I mean, if this is right, then we have such big problems that I can't imagine how we reconstruct our sort of geochemical cosmology. That's the first thing. Second thing is, even though you get a large amount of water storage in these phases, or potential water storage in these phases at great depth, where melting is occurring on Earth at the moment, at shallow depths, the behavior of water and the behavior of the light rare earth elements are very much in agreement, and we have experimental data that shows that. So in the modern Earth, the behavior of water and incompatible trace elements in terms of the